Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. There is no way out through the ballot box. The powers that control both political parties are not going to peacefully allow their removal from power. But removed they must be, if we and our children and our children's children are to have any future at all. We need to organize. We need to become strong as they become inexorably weaker. We need to be in an unassailable position before our enemies attempt to bring their genocide of our race to fruition. We need to be the decision makers and policy makers of the future for our people, the only ones. How do we begin to get from here to there? That is our subject as we listen to Dr. William Pierce's foundational work on building an organization that can be both the salvation of our folk and the master of our future. And so, I give you the words of Dr. William Pierce in his never-before-heard-on-radio, The Task of the National Alliance, Part 2. Every member of the National Alliance has had the experience of hearing a fair-minded conservative explaining that he can't support the alliance because we are not as concerned about justice for non-whites as we are about justice for whites, but who has been conspicuously silent about the Jewish treatment of the Palestinians and about every other glaring injustice in today's world when silence was the only safe response. One might point out to one of these virtuous citizens that unless drastic and sweeping measures to bring about total geographical racial separation are taken, measures which are sure to cause hardship to a great many non-whites who have never deliberately harmed us, then the white race will continue to suffer the contamination of its gene pool, which is the inevitable consequence of racial integration. One might point out that if this contamination continues, it will eventually destroy the white race, as it has destroyed segments of our race in various parts of the world throughout history, from India to South America. And one might ask, what is fair about that? One might ask whether he favors giving North America back to the Indians, since it was certainly unfair of our ancestors to take it away from them. One might ask whether he believes the whole white race should just lie down and die, since the entire history of the world in reality consists of nothing more than a series of injustices perpetrated on the weak by the strong in nature's unending process of upward struggle. And it is a fact that until this peculiar obsession with fairness to non-whites took hold of us in recent years, it has been the white race which has most often been strong, which has, in other words, been most unfair. One might point out to him that the notion of fairness is one which arose and exists in the white man's mind only. It is a notion concerned only with the white man's dealings with his own kind, and it loses its whole meaning when applied to interracial relations. But, of course, there is no point in asking such questions, in raising such points. For the fair-minded Americans who criticize our lack of charity for the enemies of our race are totally inconsistent in their logic, and logic will not persuade them. They are like the Pharisees in the old parable, who fastidiously strain out a gnat from their wine, but swallow a camel without noticing it. Their position has nothing to do with fairness or justice, but only with hypocrisy and cowardice. A lion might be fair or just if he were so inclined, but the possibility does not even exist for a sheep. What all this means for the alliance is that the moral attitudes of the better informed elements, just like those of the masses, are almost wholly dependent on external circumstances, rather than on any unyielding inner convictions. Most will never expand their ethical concepts to the extent that they see fairness and justice from a racial or cosmic viewpoint, instead of an egocentric one. Just as a sheep will never become a lion. But they most assuredly will change their attitudes about what is fair as their personal circumstances change. And a great many who will not support the alliance now will support it in the future. The alliance does not have the capability at this time to change the objective conditions which determine most people's attitudes. It must depend on the forces of history for that. It follows, therefore, that the alliance must pursue a minority strategy rather than a majority strategy for the time being, unless it abandons its fundamental approach altogether and caters instead to the short-sighted prejudices of the majority. The latter is a course wholly alien to the alliance, one which would destroy the very foundations on which it rests. Thus, the short and intermediate term strategy of the alliance is based on participation by an elite minority carefully sifted out of the overall white population, rather than on direct participation by the white masses or by the bulk of the conservative elements among the professional intellectual class. For the foreseeable future, our program is to appeal to, reach, move, and recruit the members of this radicalizable elite, wherever they may be, and to build with them a function-oriented organizational structure, a structure made up of cadres, each of whom has specific functional responsibilities. It is one thing to tackle such a building program during a time of mass revolutionary ferment, when these functional responsibilities can be oriented directly toward immediate revolutionary goals involving large numbers of people. It is quite another thing during times of relative public lethargy and indifference, when cadres and masses have much more strongly divergent interests. The latter case prevails, and the tasks of the National Alliance have been defined accordingly. These tasks, in accordance with the conclusions reached above, are not directed at attempting to persuade or mobilize the masses, or to change the objective conditions or irritants to which the masses are subjected. They are directed instead toward building a permanent basis and a permanent structure which exist independently of the masses and which grow and develop without mass participation, but which nevertheless have the capability of persuading the masses, for changing the conditions which motivate them, and for mobilizing at least portions of them at some later time. The difference may seem only one of emphasis, but it is a very important difference. One cannot hope for much success in building an organization whose entire raison d'etre is its ability to mobilize masses, when it is clear to any intelligent observer that the chance of accomplishing such mobilization is vanishingly slim. Such an organization is, in essence, an ad hoc organization, and the hoc is just not credible at this point in history. Yet the fact remains that without an organizational basis for mobilization at hand, when we reach a different point of history, one at which mass mobilization is conceivable, it cannot be accomplished. And the conditions which will prevail at such time will not be conducive to laying careful foundations and erecting sound, well-designed structures on them. The prize will fall to the faction which has done its building beforehand, not to the one which begins then. And so, the National Alliance has backed off a bit from the ad hoc approach and has addressed itself more instead to providing an organizational embodiment of a worldview, an embodiment whose value is as much per se as ad hoc, as much intrinsic as extrinsic. That is, while the tasks and functions of the Alliance are never wholly divorced from the eventual necessity of mass mobilization, neither are they wholly dependent on that eventuality. They offer to the prospective cadre worthwhile goals to which he can wholeheartedly devote all his energies for a lifetime, if need be, even if he never engages in any mass-oriented activity. At the same time, however, he is never allowed to forget that such activity must eventually come, and that the capability for it must have been prepared beforehand, if it is to be meaningful and productive. The intrinsic tasks and functions of the Alliance, those necessary for their own sake, are several. One is to provide a fixed pole of the spirit in the swirling chaos of falsehood and illusion surrounding our people in this era, an outcropping of bedrock, of immutable principle, against the drifting sands of change and decay, a citadel of the ageless values of our race. At a time when not only the alien-controlled media, but also the schools, the churches, the government, the political parties, big business and big labor, every institution with a stake in the present system, habitually lie, changing their tune from month to month, holding a moistened forefinger to the shifting breezes of opportunity before deciding what stand to take, tolerating every evil and encouraging every weakness for the sake of expediency, riddled with cynicism and a total disregard for the truth. It is essential that there be one institution which knows and speaks the truth. Even the supposedly patriotic and conservative institutions in the society of today weasel on the really vital issues, fawning at the feet of alien masters, denying the differences in the value of the various races. One institution must be incorruptible and uncompromising, speaking the truth not just on the safe issues, but on all issues. Not just the fashionable and convenient aspects of the truth, but the whole truth. One institution must, in particular, say the things about race, about the Jews, about the inequality of individuals, about the corruption of this society, about the false values on which it is based, about the inadequacy of democracy, about the falsification of our history, and about all the other things which are essential to the material and spiritual life of our people, but which other institutions will not speak about. And this one institution must not be merely a dusty repository of the truth, speaking in a quiet voice heard only by a few. Many academicians are already doing that much, at least on a few issues, reporting the truth about race in their dry professional journals, or quietly setting the historical record straight. But very few people hear or see those truths. There must be one institution which is a beacon of truth for all those who want to see, a loudspeaker for all who are willing to hear, so that the truth is at least accessible to every intelligent and open-minded man and woman of our race, to every potential member of the elite mentioned above. The masses may not want to hear or see at this time, but there are a great many individuals who do. Even though this institution may not be able to compete with the controlled media for the minds of the masses, even though it may not even try to compete, it nevertheless needs to be more than a static oracle. It needs to elaborate and elucidate the truth, to simplify and explain it, as well as proclaim it. It must speak to more than scholars, and it must be dynamic, exploring new ramifications, developing new vehicles, fiction, poetry, film, drama. It must speak to the heart as well as to the mind. In addition to the propagation of truth, a vital task of the Alliance is keeping hope alive. A key element of the strategy of the enemies of our people is convincing all of us that the destruction of the white race through race mixing is inevitable, that there is no point in resistance, that mongrelization and white decline are the wave of the future, that the Jews are unbeatable, that all the smart money is on their side, and that anyone who opposes them is a sucker, a loser, a fool. One of our responsibilities is to remind people, not necessarily the masses, but those individuals concerned with more than their sex lives and their bank accounts, our elite, that the Jews are beatable, that not everyone has given up, that there are intelligent, responsible, articulate people who are unconditionally committed to putting a final end to Jewish scheming and to this system based on Jewish values, no matter how long it takes or how much sacrifice is required. We must always keep one light burning and one door open, no matter how black the darkness before the dawn, so that every racially conscious white person has a place to turn when he is finally ready to take up the fight himself. Propagating truth, upholding hope, even for the few. Those are two very concrete and vital functions. And there is another, which is the closely related function of maintaining a living community embodying the spiritual values of our race. In a certain sense, every spiritually healthy white person does this, whether he is a member of the Alliance or not, because these values are inherent in the race soul of our people. They exist at the genetic level. But aside from the fact that there are all too few spiritually healthy people in today's sick world, that living in the midst of soul-sick people tends to be spiritually unhealthy in itself, it is important that spiritual values do more than lie dormant in our genes. It is important that they be manifested in the life of a community, that they be expressed in the program, the activities, the propaganda of a living group. And all these functions, involving truth, hope, and spirit, are clearly tied quite closely together. As already stated, the organization which wants to effectively propagate truth must do more than simply print dry news, accessible only to specialists. In order to have any effect on even an intelligent and open-minded minority of our people, it must, as stated above, speak to the heart as well as to the mind. It must employ media other than newspapers. And it follows, then, that when the Alliance is fulfilling its task of propagating truth effectively, it is also upholding hope for white survival and manifesting the spiritual values of our race at the same time. Now, because our task involves these several interrelated functions, because we are concerned not just with printing a newspaper, but with doing all the other things necessary to reach, to inform, and to move an elite minority of our people, it must also involve certain organizational functions. Even if our only function were to be the publication of a newspaper, requiring a full-time writing, editorial, and business staff of only a dozen or so cadres, we would still be obliged to concern ourselves with organization because of the necessity of carrying out our own distribution. The elite minority capable of responding to our message now consists of several hundred thousand persons, perhaps as many as 1% of the adult white population of the United States. And reaching them effectively requires an active membership of several thousand persons willing to participate in a vigorous distribution program. And doing the other things we must do, besides publishing and distributing a newspaper, requires much more in the way of organizational capacity. It requires more cadres. It requires a larger rank-and-file membership from which to draw those cadres and to carry out supporting functions, newspaper distribution being only one. And it requires a well-designed, smoothly operating organizational framework within which both cadres and rank-and-file members can function effectively in the performance of their coordinated tasks. All of these things fall into the category labeled above as intrinsic. They are necessary and worthwhile, even in an era in which mass organization for a radical purpose cannot be realistically attempted. But it is clear that our intrinsic and extrinsic functions are closely tied together. The intrinsic capabilities described above are very similar to the capabilities needed for reaching and moving a much larger number of people when conditions are proper. The organizational structure necessary for coordinating our intrinsic activities provides a nucleus around which a much larger organization can eventually be built. Today and next year, we concern ourselves almost solely with our intrinsic task. But at a later time, no matter when, we shall find that all our intrinsic labors, if we perform them well, will have laid the necessary and sufficient foundation for accomplishing our extrinsic task. You've been listening to the words of the founder of the National Alliance, Dr. William Pierce, in part two of his foundational work, The Task of the National Alliance, right here on American Dissident Voices.